Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Saturday morning, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to approve a new $1.9 trillion stimulus package to help Americans and state, local, and tribal governments weather what we hope will be the end of the coronavirus pandemic and the return to more normal economic landscapes as we move through 2021. No Republicans voted for the package, which received overwhelming Democratic support. The bill now moves to the Senate, which is also expected to approve it on a mostly party-line vote. One key difference is that the Senate will be stripping out a House provision that would increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour after the Senate parliamentarian ruled it can't be included in the package if the Senate is using the reconciliation process to pass the bill. More about that later in the hour when we speak with congressional correspondent Eva McKend. But for the next 35 or 40 minutes, we'll be speaking with Vermont's representative in the U.S. House, Peter Welch. Congressman Welch, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much, Jane.
So, Congressman Welch, let's talk get right down to it about this package, which, you know, as many Americans know, isn't a done deal yet because it still has to move through the Senate, then back to the House for final approval before it goes to President Biden. Big picture, is this what's needed to get Americans over the last of the COVID downturn?
Yes, it's going to help significantly. I mean, think about this. It's been a year that we have been struggling with COVID. It was a year ago that I remember coming home to Vermont, and I was the only person on an otherwise empty jet, the only person. And our restaurants were closed down. Our performance venues were closed down. And there was rising infection rates. We did well in Vermont, but we've lost 500,000 people in the country. Now, it's really a different situation because we have the vaccine. And the vaccines are really rolling out. We're close to 3 million a day. Vermont is ramping up. So we know we're going to get to the end, but we have to maintain vigilance. And there's been a real economic impact on our communities, our businesses, our individuals. So this package, I think, is what we need to get us to the other side of the bridge where the vaccine will have been administered to everybody.
Let's talk about some of the specifics in the package, and then I'd like to leave room to ask you what we haven't talked about that you want to highlight from the bill. And, you know, on many people's minds, perhaps, first off, is the individual stimulus checks, which are included in this package, about $1,400 per individual. And you know, I'm curious about the argument. I'm sure you've been discussing this already, but for not targeting these more specifically to Americans who really need this kind of money, rather than some Americans who could get by without it, what's the argument for trying to give as many Americans as possible $1,400 stimulus checks?
Well, first of all, I agree. That's a fair question. And where do you draw the line? And the line on this one, interestingly enough, was set largely by President Trump. If you remember back when those two Georgia Senate seats were in play, the president, then President Trump, was arguing for $2,000 checks. So that became sort of a consensus position. The cutoff is $75,000.
For individuals.
That's correct. So there's two issues here. What's the right place to have the cutoff? And my preference, frankly, is that people who need it should get more. People who don't need it shouldn't get it. But there's a second consideration, and that is the urgency of having this done quickly and done in a way that can be administratively accomplished very, very quickly. So there's a bit of a trade-off here, and I think what the Biden administration has chosen is that they want to err on the side of a package that may be a little bit on the high side as opposed to doing what happened in the Obama administration, where it was too little and it resulted in a sluggish economic recovery. So bottom line here, this is really going to be helpful to people. And with the other elements of this package that we'll talk about that help businesses, that help the state and local communities and reduce poverty among children, we, with the vaccines, can be on the road to a self-sustaining, strong economic recovery, I would think, by the later part of the year.
Well, on that, I mean, you know, obviously deficit spending needs to be paid back someday, and we're doing a lot of it these days. Are you thinking that we are going to come roaring back in 6 or 12 or 18 months? Or, you know, is this debt burden something we're going to be shouldering our children with?
Well, Jane, you know, that's a totally fair question. And we are borrowing money. So this is added to the debt. But all economists, Republican-oriented as well as Democratic, said this once-in-a-century pandemic requires the federal government, which is the only governmental entity that has the fiscal flexibility and the fiscal capacity, to borrow money and to help get us through this. So I do believe that under these circumstances, where essentially when we have the governor's shutdown order, these businesses that have been operating for years, suddenly their doors were closed, or say the Flynn Theater could no longer sell tickets. And do we want them to be able to go back to business and establish vibrancy in our communities, or do we want to let them wither and die? My view, very strongly, is that we've got to help folks get through this. And that does mean borrowing money now, and we will have to pay that back later. But the question is, if we don't borrow, we don't sustain the well-being of families, we don't get food relief out to families who are hungry, then we're going to be in a much deeper hole with much more pain if we don't act now and postpone it till later. So that's really, I think, what has been the collective decision, and was a bipartisan decision when we passed that first CARES package back in April of last year.
Yeah. And you know, we're going to talk about some of those other provisions in the package that specifically target areas where there really is a lot of need and where there's been huge upheaval and disruption because of COVID-19. But just before we leave that stimulus check topic, you know, I think that may be where some people quibble and say, sure, there are areas where we absolutely need to be doing deficit spending, because otherwise whole sectors of our economy will not survive the pandemic. And maybe it's nickel and diming at this point because there's so much money being spent. But on that question of individual stimulus payments, why not? You know, do you believe, Congressman, that this will stimulate the economy, that those who have more to spend and can do it for house improvements, or, you know, take a vacation when we're able to do so, or even a staycation, that they'll use that money and infuse it into their local economies in a way that eventually results in a bigger uptick in economic activity? Or are, on that particular note, on the individual stimulus payments, are we just borrowing from ourselves now something that we'll have to pay back in 5, 10, 20 years?
Well, we're going to have to pay it back. But I think for people who have lost their jobs and their incomes, getting that check is going to be a lifesaver. They're going to be able to pay their rent. They're going to be able to buy groceries. They're going to be able to have some security that they're not going to be totally desperate. So for them, it's existential. For folks who are maintaining their hours and their incomes, they may be able to save some of that. And some of that, they probably will save some of it. They may put in the home improvements, which obviously would be boosting the economy. Or when the travel restrictions are lifted, they'll be able to do things that will be stimulative to the economy. So, you know, I think it's a fair question. What's the right cutoff? Mm-hmm. Is 75 the right number? Is 50 the right number? And that's a very difficult one, because you don't want to leave struggling folks in the middle class who have significant payments for kids and for education and for their home mortgage. You don't want to leave them out. They frequently are. But you do want to target it for the folks who most need it. And this is by no means, this is perfect, but it's one element of an overall program that I think is really essential. And we can talk about some of those to put this in an overall context, I hope.
Yes. And you think this is the right approach in the direct stimulus payments?
Yes, I do. I think it's an element of the right approach. But I'm acknowledging that when you want to have a discussion about what's the right cutoff number, mm-hmm. or what's the eligibility, all of which requires a big administrative structure to implement, that's a fair question. But I do think part of this package absolutely should be these checks that really put the money in the hands of people, many of whom all around Vermont that I talk to every day, are just struggling, trying to figure out how to make ends meet. So this will give them some security, and it will have some economic benefit to all Vermonters.
Well, all Vermonters and those outside of Vermont as well are welcome to call in as we speak today with Congressman Peter Welch. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. Matthew's calling in from Alberg. Hi, Matthew. Go right ahead.
Oh, yes. I have a question for the Congressman, Peter Welch. People with disabilities did not qualify for the last two stimulus paychecks. Are you sure Congress this time can make that a point for the stimulus payment to people that, that are on SSDI and SSI to be able to make sure they will be able to receive it this time, the stimulus payment checks, or dependent, et cetera?
Well, a dependent does get the check. Whether you specifically get it in your particular circumstances, I'm not positive, and I encourage you to call my office and we can give you a specific answer.
Yeah, and that question of dependents, this is a little bit different, this round of stimulus checks, from the previous rounds, correct? In that I believe even children, minors, minor dependents are eligible for $1,400 apiece. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So in the past, it was a lower amount in the first stimulus checks and no money for minor children in the second round of stimulus. And in this one, it would be $1,400, same as the adult amount.
That's correct. So you're having a program that is really about helping families get through this. And anybody who has children knows that there's a lot of expenses, including ones you don't anticipate. So, yes, dependent children are included in this.
Another big change in this package is a change to the way the Earned Income Child Tax Credit is given to families. And this, too, would be a more direct payment approach. Can you describe it and why Congress thinks, or why at least the House thinks, this is the right approach? Democratic House members, maybe?
In fact, Mitt Romney and a lot of Republicans have been strong supporters of the Earned Income Tax Credit and also the Child Care Tax Credit. And I think this is really critical. This is going to reduce childhood poverty by about 25%, if not more. And it's targeted directly to folks who have low income. The Earned Income Tax Credit goes to people who earn, who are working, but not making, in many cases, anything close to what's necessary to survive. So they could get a check from the government that reflects that they've worked, but they can't pay their bills. And the child care tax credit is much the same. And these two things, I think, are really important because I think they're likely to endure, and it's going to make much more progressive the tax system. You know, it's really terrible in this country when you have a family, a parent, who's working full time, and they still can't even come close to paying their bills. The Earned Income Tax Credit is an effort to provide them with some recognition in the form of refundable payments that help them pay their family bills.
How much could a family expect to receive over the course of a year in this changed approach?
It varies, Jane, depending on what your income is.
Right. But the maximum would be?
I'm not sure if you're asking me right now, but I will get that.
Yes, and I should have known that, too. I should have looked that up before the start of the show, so I'll see if I can get that number as well. Let's talk a little bit, one more thing on young people here that certainly affects families and really affects families' ability to work as well as young people's ability to learn. Reopening schools is a major priority of the Biden administration, although there has been some confusion over exactly what the goalpost is for, you know, what he would call success. Not a lot of confusion here in Vermont, though. Governor Phil Scott wants to see all Vermont schools, including high schools, open for full-time in-person learning by the middle of April. Could you talk a little bit about the $170 billion included in this bill and how you think it might help Vermont schools specifically as they work to reopen or stay open?
Yes. Well, first of all, I absolutely think it's essential we get our schools open. Kids need it. In-person learning, socializing, all those things that happen at school that only happen in person. Those kids, it's been tough. They haven't been able to do that for almost a year. Secondly, parents need kids to be able to go to school. It's been so, so hard for working families who where parents get called back to work, but they don't have childcare, and they're supposed to be able to be schooling their kids at home even as they're supposed to work. And it's resulted in a significant reduction in the burden falls on women much more than men, that they have not been able to continue participating in the labor force. So this is, I think, the opening of schools is really important. That money is going to go to schools to help them do the things that are necessary. And that is everything from getting extra personnel for this transition back to in-person learning, maybe more nurses, folks to monitor temperatures and do checks as kids come to school, to help inside the school to make certain you can set up classrooms that have appropriate social distancing. And I remember back early in the pandemic going to Winooski in the school district there, where the folks, Sean McMahon and other folks, were doing such a good job. But they showed me all of the steps they had to take. And I remember asking him, this has got to be expensive. And I think it was $2 million. So this money is a recognition by the federal government that opening schools is easier said than done. And it requires resources and the spending of money in order to do it safely for our kids and our teachers. And that's what this money is for.
When it comes to how the money can be spent, there are those short-term needs, more personnel, more PPE, the ability to buy stuff, sort of small-scale infrastructure changes so distancing can be maintained. But there's also longer-term investments that in many schools, and certainly here in Vermont, were delayed that now may be essential, such as really revamped and improved ventilation systems. Is that something that schools can use, can draw down this money for, even if it's not a short-term issue, but a more longer-term infrastructure issue for their schools?
Yeah, there's going to, the schools in the state and local communities that I want to talk about, they're going to get money, are going to have considerable flexibility. You know, I talked to Governor Scott a number of times about this, and one of the big concerns he had was as much flexibility as possible. And it's something that I've advocated very strongly for, because the folks in Montpelier, our legislators and our governor, I think are in a much better position to make those micro decisions about the best allocation of resources. And I think that's true at the school level as well. The requirement is that the money have a COVID-related nexus. So this can't be just to replace other sources of revenue. But I think we should be flexible, because what will help us with COVID can be different in, from school to school. And obviously, ventilation is an extremely important component of the health and welfare of our kids. So I, this bill does have much more flexibility than past bills, and I favor flexibility. And by the way, Jane, on that, this is where there's going to be an enormous amount of responsibility on the part of our legislature, our governor, and our local select boards, because they're going to get money as well. And the future of Vermont is going to be very much affected by the care and wisdom of these decisions that are made at a state and local level. Now, I have a great deal of confidence that that's the best place for these decisions to be made. And I see our job here, my job, Bernie's and Patrick's, is to get those resources back to Vermont, but to give them some flexibility so that they can do things that are going to help bring us back. And by the way, that would include with some of the like $650 million that the state is going to get, helping out some of our small businesses that have really, really had to struggle, like our restaurants, like our performance venues, businesses where they really can't be back in full operation until everybody's safe, vaccinated, and we're on top of the virus.
And let's go to Alton, who's calling in from Walcott. Hi, Alton. Go right ahead.
Hello. I guess Representative Welch has partially answered my question already, but I was worried about spending, you know, writing checks to, say, a restaurant that's on the edge of going out of business if the virus is still raging. And I'm worried that I'm hoping that we will send those checks out when the virus is on an ebb, so maybe in spring sometime, when rather than administratively, we get all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, now send them out. Take into consideration the situation on the virus, you know, what's happening to the
right. Yeah, well, I think that's right. Because people who are hurting, like restaurant owners, they need help now. You know, if they are made to try to hang on until everybody's vaccinated and people can come back, they'll be gone. And we've already lost a lot of restaurants. And by the way, you know, we're focusing on individuals as part of this, and we've got to do that. But it's really important that we focus on communities, because when we get to the other side of the virus, we want that vibrancy that we have in our local towns and cities that is a result of the arts. It's a result of the restaurants. It's a result of the performance spaces that people can go to. So this does have to be comprehensive. We want people to get through it, and we want our communities to get through it, so that we can then rebuild stronger. By the way, Jane, I did have in the break, I was able to get the info on the child care tax credit.
Oh, thank you.
Kids under six, it's $3,600. Over six, it's $3,000. And the earned income tax credit is up to $1,052. So that's for a parent who's working, but is below the minimum of what's required to basically be above poverty.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate that update. And, you know, it is interesting to think about that in the context of how that change to how that tax credit is sort of administered could, as you said, Congressman, hold forward through the pandemic. That could be a change that affects families and poverty even after we have moved through most of the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's right. That's durable. You know, the checks are a one-time event, and I hope the families who get them, they use it to get the things they need, food, pay the rent, and necessities. And some folks who are in a position where they don't have to spend it all, when they do, they do it wisely. But it's a one-time event. The earned income tax credit is going to help low-income families with children for generations, and it's a significant ongoing opportunity to reduce childhood poverty, which is just really tough.
Before the break, we were talking about you were saying that state legislatures are going to have some flexibility in administering the funds that are coming in, including about $650 million for Vermont. And in the bill itself overall, I think it's about $350 billion going to state and municipal governments and tribal governments. In the first coronavirus aid package, there was, you know, flexibility in how state governments were able to utilize the money to create programs to help out those in need. But there were also restrictions. So, for example, municipal governments had no ability to draw down federal funds to balance their budgets. And, you know, the state of Vermont has done pretty well in terms of its budget, thanks in large part to the federal stimulus payments. But for municipal governments, is there more flexibility in how they themselves are able to use the money in this new aid package?
Well, there is a good deal of flexibility, but the connection has to be related to COVID. All right, so the money can't simply be used to stop collecting property taxes, let's say, for a period of time. It has to be related to COVID, and I think that's appropriate. There was a pushback, and I thought a legitimate point, from some of my Republican colleagues that they didn't want this to be, quote, a bailout. You know, some states, and Vermont is in this position, has, for instance, challenges with our pension fund. Should this money be used for that? Well, in fact, it can't be. That whatever our pension situation is not related to COVID. It's not related to COVID. But there's a good deal of flexibility, and the state used it well. You know, in our state, we have real pain in our tourism industry. A lot of bed and breakfast, a lot of the ski areas where there are these small businesses that depend on that tourism. And that's a huge part of our economy. They really were hurt. And with that first round of money that went to the state of Vermont, the legislature and governor tried to help out. And I think that made sense. They also tried to help out our farm economy, which was reeling even as we went into this, it made all the more difficult as a result of COVID. So these were decisions that reflected a Vermont-specific situations. And that's why I think it's really terrific to have the governor and the legislature be the ones that have to make those calls about where best to utilize this money. Our situation in Vermont, for instance, is just different than, say, the situation in Massachusetts.
We have a question from Christy Nold on Twitter, who says, I'm a public school teacher who works in a district using the hybrid model. I'm in school 4 days per week, and my students come in two-day cohorts. We use this model because we're not able to physically fit all students in our classrooms. I hear you, Representative Welch, and others call for a return to full in-person learning. How do we do this while maintaining safe distancing practices?
Well, that clearly has to be done at the local level. Those practical, very difficult implementation decisions simply can't be made in Washington. So that person would know far better how best to do it and what the limits are.
But wouldn't it suggest, I mean, I'm not speaking for Christy here, but it would suggest that that is their limit. If they had the space to do it, they would be in person, but they don't. And now what they're getting are calls to open fully without a response that seems to give them a way to do that with they don't have more physical space necessarily.
Right. But what's the role that the local community has to play? What's the role the federal government has to play? I'm in no position to second guess the decisions that Christy and others in that school district make. What I am in a position to do is to try to get them the resources so that they have the broadest possible option to do the best possible job of getting as many kids in school as soon as possible. How to do that has to be done at a local level. But what I don't want to have happen is that they're limited because they don't have the resources. And that might be bringing in an extra classroom. It might be, you know, all the creative things that people at the local level do to solve problems. Oftentimes they need some resources to do it. So our job here is to try to help those people have the resources they need, and then their job is to try to make those really, really difficult practical decisions on how best to implement it. And, you know, in some schools, it could be that there's real limits, and it has to be the two and two. You know, I won't second guess of the efforts of people making good faith. What I will do is do everything I can to get them the resources they need so they have the best possible chance of getting our kids back to school.
I would assume you're hearing from a lot of Vermont teachers and Vermont families and educators on this score who are getting in touch with your office. Is what you're hearing that they need more resources or something different, that they're feeling a top-down push without an understanding of what on the ground is actually happening that maybe doesn't involve more money?
Well, the two things that I hear from parents, I hear real concern about their kids not being in school.
Mm-hmm.
From teachers, I hear real concerns about safety. And frankly, they're both right. I mean, the parents and kids need to be in school. Teachers need to be safe and kids need to be safe. And that's really tense once you go from the general discussion to, all right, how are we going to open up this school for these many kids? Are we going to do it at all? Are we going to do it on a hybrid model? Is there some way we can get everybody back in? But what we have happening now is, number one, you've got more and more people are getting vaccinated. So obviously that's incredibly helpful on the safety issue. And then second, we're getting federal money to our schools so that they have resources to make practical decisions about how best to get those kids safely back to school. So it's the two things. It's vaccination, which helps our, obviously, the teachers, the kids, the parents, but it's also the resources to give that flexibility for implementation decisions.
Let's go to Sarah, who's with us from South Burlington. Sarah, go right ahead.
I have a question about the $15 minimum wage and just wondered if we could debate a number in the middle, like $12.50, or does it have to be $15 or nothing?
Yeah, so maybe, this is a good part for us to talk about, because in the House package, it is a $15 minimum wage increase up to $15, but that's likely not to be in the Senate package at all. So maybe you could talk specifically to Sarah's question, and then we can talk about, you know, what happens next for that push for $15.
Right. Well, first of all, I support the $15 minimum wage. That's $30,000 a year. You just think about what your expenses are, anyone's expenses are, especially if they have kids. It's very tough to pay your bills. Think about what the rent is, say, if you live in Burlington, or many parts of Vermont where housing is very, very expensive. and our wages are low. So I do support the $15. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. It's like $14,000 a year. Now, we all know that as a practical matter means the federal government doesn't have the minimum wage. What we had done in Vermont, and this happened when I was serving in the General Assembly, I was in the Senate, and Jim Douglas was the governor. We had a debate about raising the minimum wage, and there was a compromise where we attached an inflation adjustment each year, and that was supported by Governor Douglas and by the Democrats. So we've had in Vermont that escalator so that our minimum wage, it's not 15, but it's, you know, it's much more reasonable. So I support it. The Senate is debated, and it's not – some of the Democrats there don't support the 15. Keep in mind, by the way, this is phased in over 5 years, so it's not like tomorrow you would wake up and it suddenly goes to 15. It would be phased in. And it'll be in the Senate where there'll be some discussion about whether there should be a compromise number. So that's always possible, but just so you know where I'm coming from, I do support the $15.
Senator Bernie Sanders told Henry Epp here on VPR before the Senate parliamentarian had ruled that if the $15 minimum wage didn't move forward in this stimulus package, it was going to be really tough to get it through in any other way. Do you plan to still fight for a $15 minimum wage? Do you think that's a possibility in this Congress?
Well, it is in the House. We passed it.
Right.
And Senator Sanders has got a much more challenging political environment in the Senate. So he's the one who can best speak to the problems in the Senate that have to be overcome in order to pass this. And the challenge is there is that it's a 50-50 Senate with Kamala, Vice President Harris being the tiebreaker. And a couple of the Democrats like Kirsten Sinema from Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia they oppose the $15 minimum wage. So somehow, some way, Bernie and the other senators supporting this are going to have to get past that.
So in that case, though, do you think for the House, you know, the House has sort of made its position clear and who supports what, but moving forward, it's not going to be an issue that's worth taking up for the House because there isn't that support in the Senate. So it's going to have to be something that the Senate moves forward with before you touch it again?
No, I don't think so. I think we're going to pass a standalone bill. And in fact, I like standalone bills because then everybody knows what's in it as opposed to these massive bills where you just focus on one thing. Like, for instance, in the beginning of our conversation, we just focused on the checks when that's only one element of this $1.9 trillion package to try to help us get through COVID. So I favor doing something very specific. But the problem in the Senate is it looks like they're two votes short. That could change.
Congressman, this bill that we've been spending our whole time talking about, because it is so important, is also the first major piece of legislation that will be passed through Congress under new President Joe Biden. You know, Biden promised to work with congressional Republicans to get things done and to unite all Americans and to sort of create a bipartisan system where it doesn't feel quite so partisan and polarized in Washington. And yet no House Republicans voted in favor of this stimulus package. And in the Senate, they're using the reconciliation process to ensure that they only need a majority vote with, you know, as you mentioned, the tie-breaking vote from Vice President Harris. You also take great pains to talk about the importance of finding bipartisan agreement and working with, not just against, your colleagues of different political persuasions. So what do you think this says about the state of the U.S. government, that there will quite likely be little to no Republican support of the first big piece of legislation under the new president?
Well, count me as among the disappointed, but the history here is pretty clear, especially with Senator McConnell in the Senate. He made a decision that politically it was much better for him to be opposed to anything that then President Obama proposed. And his calculation, and he's been explicit about this, was that if the president failed to do something or there was gridlock, it would be the incumbent president who bore the electoral blame for that. And in fact, it turned out he was probably right on that as a political calculation. But he was wrong on that as far as what's good for America. And Joe Biden, his whole political life over four decades has been about trying to find common ground with Republicans, even as he stood up for his own principles. But we're in a Congress that is divided. We're in a Congress where well over 100 of my colleagues in the House did something that I find extraordinary. They voted to overturn the election of Joe Biden. And that all happened on the day the mob attacked the Capitol on January 6th. And five people got killed, including one officer. And then two later died. Two officers died later from that. So this is a different situation. But what I would say, and this is what President Biden has focused on, the bill he's put together has about 70% support among the American public, according to polls. Many municipal mayors support it, including Republicans. Many Republican governors support it. So if bipartisanship is judged by the content of the bill and the support it has among a cross-section of both parties, then we've achieved it here. And what I've been arguing here with my colleagues, my Republican colleagues, is that the things we need in this country right now, like broadband, we all need it, like the virus, like the vaccine for the virus, like an infrastructure plan, we need that in a blue state like Vermont, which went 70% for Biden, or a red state like Wyoming, which went 70% for Trump. The things we're advocating are not partisan deals. They're things that are really essential to the health and well-being of all Americans. So I do see this as having broad, universal benefit. We get infrastructure. We get broadband to rural communities, whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Biden. That's a good thing for America. So in that sense, the content of this has broad support because it does broadly benefit all Americans.
Well, let's leave it there for today. I'm sure we'll hear more from you soon. That's Representative Peter Welch. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Jane, thank you very much. And we're going to miss you, Jane, but you'll be there in another capacity.
I will. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. That's Representative Peter Welch. Representative Welch gave us the scoop on what he sees benefiting Vermont in the just passed COVID relief bill the U.S. House voted out on Saturday. But that package still needs to go through the Senate, where even though the Democrats hold a voting majority with Vice President Kamala Harris, there still may be some different priorities that need to be reconciled. Plus, the Senate parliamentarian has said no to including language that would increase the federal minimum wage to $15. But some in Washington, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, feel strongly now is the time to make that a reality. Joining us now to talk this all over and give us some broad perspective on the atmosphere in Congress is Eva McKend, a congressional correspondent for Spectrum News in Washington, D.C. And many of you will also remember Eva from her reporting days at WCAX-TV here in Vermont. Eva, so nice to have you back virtually in Vermont with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jane. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, yours too. So we talked over with Representative Welch some of the priorities that made it through into and through the House package. Let's talk about what might happen in the Senate, the timeline and prospects for that stimulus bill in the Senate. What do you think the changes might be?
So now that it heads over to the Senate, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, he has said that he is hoping to get this all done and signed into law by President Biden by mid-March. That's when key unemployment benefits expire. The Biden administration has said that they really want to still try. They couldn't get any Republicans on board in the House, but they're really hoping that they might be able to peel off a few Republicans in the Senate, though it is looking highly unlikely. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell coming out on Friday night, and basically, you know, he is the voice of Republicans in the Senate saying he doesn't endorse this, not in the slightest, that more than 90% of the K-12 school funding would not go out in this fiscal year, and basically throwing cold water on the bill. And when he comes out in that way, it's going to be hard for Republicans to break from him.
You know, we were just talking with Representative Welch about the money that would go to schools, quite a significant amount of money. And, you know, if that's not likely to actually reach schools during this school year, it's not likely something that's going to help them reopen in this school year at all. Is that really the truth about that money, that funding?
So this is confusing, Jane, and this is what happens when a bill is this large, right? It's nearly 600 pages. This is a debate that's not entirely clear to me. McConnell says it's not, but Congressman John Yarmuth, he's the chair of the House Budget Committee. He says all of the money will be available immediately, that there's a process in which this can happen, that there are waivers that can be applied for, et cetera. So I'm not entirely sure. The Republicans are saying the money won't be accessible, but key Democrats say that it will.
Eva, you mentioned that there may be some arm twisting going on to try to get at least a couple of Republicans to sign on to the stimulus package, although that appears unlikely. Is there any sense that any Democrats could wind up going against it?
Well, the Senator Schumer can't afford to lose any Democrats.
Right.
Not one. So I don't see that happening. I think that especially with the minimum wage stripped out of the Senate version, with the Senate parliamentarian ruling that raising the minimum wage is not a budget issue, I don't see Senator Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Sinema of Arizona peeling off. They're the two that the Democrats have to be concerned about. They're the moderates. But I think that there is such wide support for the bill around the country that they would receive the full wrath of the party if they didn't move forward with this bill. So I don't see that, especially with minimum wages no longer a factor in the Senate. I don't see Democrats not banding together to get this done by the 15th.
You mentioned that there is pretty broad support for this package, generally speaking, in the American public. The Republicans in the U.S. Senate have some cover to vote against it because they know that with the tie-breaking vote from Vice President Harris, that this aid package will still pass if all of the Democrats are on board. Do you think that some political maneuvering, some compromises could be made to get some Republicans on board? Or is this political cover to be able to say no to it for strategic reasons and not even really worth haggling to try to get to some common ground?
It's certainly an uphill battle for the Biden administration and Senator Schumer to get Republicans on board, but it's not impossible. You know, there are more independent-minded Republicans in the Senate that could be persuaded. Senator Murkowski is very comfortable in Alaska. Really, she's a Republican, but really has an independent streak. So maybe she could be convinced. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes and what policy priorities that the Biden administration might be able to promise her in exchange for her cooperation. But I still would say it's going to be very, very difficult for Democrats to peel off any Republicans.
Yeah, so there isn't anything specific that you could point to that you would say, you know, if this was in the bill or if this was taken out of the bill, you might get Republican support. Like nothing specific that seems like an easy target to change.
Not in this package. I think maybe if there are promises for future legislation, maybe in terms of infrastructure policy, that's an area where a lot of states stand to benefit. So maybe in other huge packages, promises to include infrastructure projects in red states, I could see that happening, but not with this particular legislation because, Jane, there are certain Republicans that didn't want another coronavirus relief package at all.
Mm-hmm.
They think the whole thing is wasteful.
Despite the fact that most Americans say yes to it, they approve of it.
Yes, most Americans do. But Senator Paul, for instance, did not want another package. He thought that the trillions that have already gone out and some of which has not been spent yet in certain states, that this was not necessary.
Representative Welch said, yes, the $15 minimum wage is going to be stripped out of the Senate bill, but that the House would still likely propose a standalone $15 minimum wage. Bernie Sanders told All Things Considered host Henry Epp he didn't see that having much chance of passage in the Senate right now as a standalone bill. It really would need to be included in this stimulus package, and now it won't be. Eva, where do you see that fight over the minimum wage going?
So this is an important question because progressive Democrats say we got together a diverse coalition of young folks, of folks of color, of low-wage workers, of poor people, right? The Poor People's Campaign, that voted for Joe Biden because we wanted bold, progressive policy change. And if you don't make this happen, if you don't increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and this is an incremental increase, right? This is not overnight. This would be a gradual increase over several years. Then we can't go back to these groups and tell them to keep voting for Democrats if they don't see real substantive change. Now, Congressman Yarmuth, who I mentioned before, the chair of the Budget Committee, he tells me, he says that before the next election, Democrats will increase the wage. He even told me that I could hold him to it. So I don't know how they're going to do it, because budget reconciliation, I think, would be the only process, unless in the next budget reconciliation bill, if they try to challenge the Senate parliamentarian and Democratic senators get a little bit more bullish and aggressive, like we've seen Republicans do in the past, and really try to push it in the bill. But for right now, I don't see the policy path forward. But he told me to hold him to it, so I will.
And even with reconciliation, as you mentioned, they'd have to get back on board at least a couple of Senate Democrats who at the moment don't support that $15 minimum wage increase.
That's right. Or have to be willing to go down from 15. Senator Romney, Senator Cotton, two Republicans, they say that they are for increasing the wage to $10 an hour. Maybe there's some negotiation there. That is a way that maybe they could get some Republicans if they come off of this 15. But I don't see a clear policy path forward right now.
Eva, I'm curious to hear from you, since you're in Washington, you're in Congress all the time, you're speaking with important leaders in House and Senate. How does the atmosphere feel different now here on the first day of March than it did a month or 2 months or 3 months ago?
I would still say that it's very tense still. I would say, you know, we are all walking around with masks, so you can't see people's facial expressions as much, which I think changes sort of a way of communication. But I would say, away from the cameras, away from the House floor and the C-SPAN feed, Democrats and Republicans do have good working relationships. I think that sometimes it can all kind of become theater, and people don't realize that a lot of these members, even though they are of different parties and have very different policy beliefs, they are actually pretty friendly towards one another.
Well, I appreciate your insight and really glad to have you joining us today. Eva McKend is a congressional correspondent for Spectrum News in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Eva.
Thank you so much, Jane, and congratulations on the expansion of But Why.
Thank you. I appreciate that.